I'm Gary Knoll, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour, and I welcome you. This is an original, in-depth investigative report on Making Sense of the Middle East, a special broadcast. Joining me in this hour will be Professor Norman Pollack, Professor Emeritus of History at Michigan State University, and we will be sharing insights, commentaries, audio clips on every aspect of Middle East problems. Who's involved? What is the truth? Well, let us begin. Russia, it turns out, was correct. ISIS oil is going to Turkey. Mind you, why is this important? Because Turkey is supposed to be the ally, along with Saudi Arabia, helping lead the efforts to get rid of ISIS in Syria. And yet they're funding all of these radical terrorism groups. And there are many of these terrorist groups, over 15, that are being funded, trained, and armed by Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and the United States. So try to get rid of the money. This is coming from Sputnik. Quote, Turkey has turned into a major consumer of oil from the so-called Islamic State extremist group. The author of the article continued, quote, Turkish businessmen signed deals on oil purchases with jihadists, that means radical terrorists, that goes to those who behead people, who blow people up, allowing them to get revenues of $10 million a week. The Kremlin's long time ago obtained information that oil from ISIL seized territories in Syria is being transferred to Turkey, and the fact that Russia aerospace forces started to conduct more attacks against ISIL infrastructure couldn't be overlooked by Turkey. According to Bild, and this is a publication, the Turkish policies regarding jihadists are not quite transparent. Although Turkey provided Americans with opportunities to use the country's airbase for launching attacks against ISIL positions, the head of Turkey allows terrorists sneaking into Syria to go through Turkey without hindrance. At the same time, Turkey is not the only state that is making dirty oil deals with the Islamic State, militants for its own profit. Smugglers supply Jordan, Kurdistan, in which black market trade is flourishing. With ISIL oil, the senior analyst of the Barcelona Center for International Affairs claimed that they have plenty of money. Russian President Vladimir Putin, after a press conference with the French president, said that significant amounts of oil from ISIL-controlled areas in Syria is being transported to Turkey. Quote, we are speaking about industrial-scale supplies of oil from Syrian territories seized by terrorists, from these exact areas and not from any others. And we can observe from the air where those cars are heading to. They are moving to Turkey day and night. End quote. So, what do we learn? We learn that our allies are not just training and supporting and financing, but actually buying the oil and giving it hundreds of millions of dollars to the people that we're supposed to be trying to eliminate. Now, that leads me to this. And I found this was important. This is from Peter Van Buren, from an important blog. He says, meanwhile, quote, wars are expensive. The recruitment and sustainment of fighters in the field, the ongoing purchases of weapons, munitions, as well as the myriad other costs of struggle add up. So why isn't the United States going after Islamic State funding sources as a way of lessening or eliminating their strength and making war? Follow the money back. Cut it off. And you strike a blow much more devastating than an airstrike. But that is not happening. Why? Many have long held that Sunni terror groups, ISIS, and now Al-Qaeda before them, are funded via the Gulf states, such as Saudi Arabia, who are also long-term American allies. Direct links are difficult to prove, particularly if the United States chooses not to prove them. The issue is exacerbated by suggestions that the money comes from donors, not directly from national treasuries, and may be routed through legitimate charitable organizations or front-end companies. In fact, one person concerned about Saudi funding was then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who warned in a 2009 message on WikiLeaks that donors in Saudi Arabia were the, quote, most significant source of funding to Sunni terrorist groups worldwide, end quote. Mind you, she didn't know that this would ever become public. This is what Julian Assange's WikiLeaks was able to download and now made public. Quote, this is Hillary Clinton. Now compare Hillary Clinton's support of Saudi Arabia, wanting deals to be made with Saudi Arabia, taking many of the people donated to the Clinton Foundation, hundreds of millions of dollars, and then she gives them weapons contracts, approves weapon contract to Saudi Arabia. And she gets money to the Clinton Foundation, millions of dollars the Saudis have given the Clinton Foundation. But privately, and to the State Department, she said, quote, most significant source of funding to Sunni terrorist groups worldwide. Well, then there's an enormous contradiction. Do you think that any Republican or any other Democrat would ask her to qualify how she says that they are the biggest supporters of terrorism in the world? And at the same time, my husband and I's foundation took tens of millions of dollars, and we make sure that they get billions of dollars in weapons deals. There's a big gap here in credibility. I'm interested to see which journalists in America, which person campaigning will challenge her to see the reconciliation of this discrepancies. Now, at the G20 meeting, President Vladimir Putin said out loud what has otherwise not been publicly discussed much in public. He announced that he has shared intelligence with the other 20 member states, which reveals 40 countries from which ISIS finances the majority of its terrorist activities. And by the way, the list included most of the G20 people. So he's saying, hey, we have good intelligence showing that you, France, and you, Italy, and you, Germany, are also supporting ISIS and these terrorist groups through different ways. He put them on notice. The American media didn't touch it. Putin's list of funders has not been made public. Now, here's who belongs to G20. Argentina, Australia, there's a problem. Brazil, there's a problem. Canada, there's a huge fascistic problem. China, France, Germany, India, Indonesia, Italy, Japan, Mexico, Russia, Saudi Arabia, South Africa, South Korea, Turkey, United Kingdom, and the United States and the European Union. Let's look at oil. One source of income for ISIS is and has robustly been oil sales. In the early days of the air campaign, American officials made a point to say that the Islamic State's oil drilling assets were high on the target list, yet few sites have been actually damaged. A Pentagon spokesman explained that the coalition has actually been trying to spare some of ISIS's largest oil production facilities, quote, recognizing that they remain the property of the Syrian people, end quote, and to limit collateral damage to civilians nearby. The U.S. only this week began a slightly more aggressive approach towards the oil, albeit bombing tanker trucks, not the infrastructure behind them. The trucks were destroyed at the Abu Qabal oil collection point near the Iraqi border. Conservative estimates are that the Islamic State takes in between $1 to $2 million a day from oil sales. Some see the number as higher, up to $4 million a day. As recently as February, however, the Pentagon claimed that oil was no longer ISIS's main way to raise money, having been bypassed by those donations from unspecified sources and smuggling. Now, one of the issues was selling oil by anyone, including ISIS, is bringing this stuff to market. Oil must be taken from the ground using heavy equipment, possibly refined, stored, loaded into trucks and pipelines, moved somewhere, and then sold onto the worldwide market. Large amounts of money must be exchanged, and $1 to $4 million a day is a lot of cash to deal with on a daily basis. It may be that some sort of electronic transactions that have somehow to date eluded the United States are involved. Every single electronic message in the world is held by the National Security Agency. So it is not humanly possible for ISIL, any group or part of it, to transfer money and the United States not know it. Interesting, The Guardian reported a U.S.-led raid on the compound housing the Islamic State's chief financial officer produced evidence that Turkish officials directly dealt with ranking ISIS members, including the ISIS officer responsible for directing the terror army oil and gas operations in Syria. Turkey's open-door policy, in which it allowed its southern border to serve as an unofficial transit point in and out of Syria, has been said to be one of ISIS's main routes for getting their oil to market. A Turkish apologist claimed that the oil is moved only via small diameter plastic irrigation pipes and hence hard to monitor. That's nonsense. A smuggled barrel of oil is sold for about $50 on the black market. This means several millions of dollars a day of oil would require a very large number of very small pipes. Others believe Turkey and Iraq are the buyers. They travel into Syria with their own trucks and purchase the ISIS oil right at the refineries, transporting themselves out of Syria. Convoys of trucks are easy to spot from the air and easy to destroy from the air, though up till now the United States has not done so. And yet no one has challenged the President of the United States or any member of Congress on the National Security Committees as to why that has happened. And yet, when you hear the people, the fascists, and the war hawks on the media say we need boots on the ground, we've got to stop this terrorism, not once do you hear them talk about a different way of doing it. In other words, going after the source, the wells, and the trucks, and then confiscating the accounts that are wire transferred. Now, here's something to add to that. This is from a news report from Sputnik News, and it says Turkey arrests generals, their own generals, for stopping Syrian-bound trucks filled with arms. Quote, two Turkish generals and a colonel were detained on Saturday for intercepting Syrian-bound trucks that belonged to Turkey's National Intelligence Organization, MIT, the newspaper Today's Zaman reported. The Major General Aydın and Brigadier General and a former criminal laboratory head colonel stopped Syrian-bound trucks in southern Turkey after they received information from an anonymous source that the trucks were illegally carrying weapons to militants in Syria. When the information about the trucks became public, the National Intelligence Organization of Turkey and high-ranking Turkish politicians, including the president, who was prime minister back then, and the existing prime minister, then the country's foreign minister, were furious at the generals for stopping the trucks and said the Syrian-bound trucks were carrying, quote, humanitarian aid. Later, they would rescind that. And then they wanted to bring espionage charges against the generals for doing their job. And yet the generals involved in the interception confirmed that the Syrian-bound trucks weren't going to an area where the Turkmen lived, but to an area populated by radical groups. And what did Turkey do? Turkey then not only arrested the people who stopped the illegal weapons from going to the terrorist, but then any newspaper in Turkey that reported the truth, its offices were shut down. Two Turkish journalists were arrested for covering a story and releasing pictures, claiming that Turkish trucks provided weapons to Syrian rebels. So here we have it. Generals, journalists, freedom of speech, telling the truth. That should be enough for American media to do a story on. Lo and behold, American media doesn't do anything unless they're told to and what to say by the White House. And this is from Michael Snyder. Quote, Turkey, the country ISIS uses as a home base and where it has sold $800 million of oil. Quote, If we truly want to get rid of ISIS, why aren't we doing anything about the Islamic governments that are funding them, aiding them, and facilitating the sale of their oil? ISIS fighters hop back and forth over the Turkish border with impunity. There are direct dealings with Turkish officials and ranking ISIS members, and more than $800 million worth of ISIS oil has been sold in Turkey. If these things are true, action must be taken. According to a recent Rasmussen Report survey, 92% of Americans consider Islamic terrorism to be a serious threat to the United States, and a Washington Post ABC survey found that 83% of registered voters believe that a terror attack that causes a large amount of casualties inside the United States is likely in the near future. At this point, most Americans have absolutely no idea what is taking place in Iraq and Syria, and the mainstream media is certainly not being straight with us. That is why I want to share with you some key excerpts from an amazing article that was written by award-winning journalist and best-selling author, Dr. Amid. According to his bio, he has written for The Independent on Sunday, The Scotsman, and The Sydney Morning Herald, and The Huffington Post, The New Statesman, etc., and La Mode. And, quote, this is what he has to say. A senior Western official familiar with a large cache of intelligence obtained this summer from a major raid on an ISIS safe house told The Guardian that, quote, direct dealings with Turkish officials and ranking ISIS members are now undeniable. The same official confirmed that Turkey, a longstanding member of NATO, is not just supporting ISIS, but also other jihadist groups, including Al-Sham and Al-Nusra, Al-Qaeda's affiliate in Syria. The distinctions they draw with other opposition groups are thin indeed, and there is no doubt at all that they militarily cooperate with both, end quote. But it isn't just that Turkey and ISIS have direct dealings with each other. In the article, Ahmed goes on to explain that ISIS uses Turkey's territory as a home base from which to conduct attacks, and ISIS trucks are able to travel back and forth across the border throughout Turkey very freely. Quote from the article, the former ISIS fighter told Newsweek that Turkey was allowing ISIS trucks from Raqqa to cross the border through Turkey and then back across the border to attack Syrian Kurds in the city in northern Syria. ISIS militants would freely travel through Turkey in a convoy of trucks and stop at safe houses in Turkey along the way. The former ISIS communications technician also admitted that he would routinely, quote, connect ISIS field captains with commanders from Syria with people in Turkey on innumerable occasions, adding that, quote, the people they talked to were Turkish officials. ISIS commanders told us to fear nothing at all because there was full cooperation with the Turks, end quote. Now, we know that American officials are aware of all this. British also, German also. So everyone, except the American people, know the truth, that our primary ally in the fight against ISIS in the Middle East is the major supporter, financier, protector of ISIS. And I think that is something that the American media has refused to deal with. Now I'm going to share something that I'm sure people in this audience are not familiar with. I'm going to share direct information from WikiLeaks files. WikiLeaks, of course, is very important because it's where we get the truth. Quote, on the 31st of 2013, U.S. President Barack Obama announced that he intended to launch a military attack on Syria in response to a chemical weapons attack in that country that the U.S. blamed on the Syrian government. Obama assured the U.S. public that this would be a limited action solely intended to punish the Assad government for using chemical weapons. The goal of U.S. military action would not to be to overthrow the Assad government, nor to change the balance of forces in Syria's sectarian civil war. History shows that public understanding of U.S. foreign policy depends crucially on assessing the motivations of U.S. officials. It is likely inevitable as a result of the U.S. officials will present themselves to the public as having more noble motivations than they share with each other in private. And therefore, that if members of the public had access to the motivation shared in private, they might make different assessments of U.S. policy. This is a key reason why WikiLeaks publishing of U.S. diplomatic cables was so important. The cables gave the public a recent window into the strategies and motivations of U.S. officials as they expressed them to each other, not as they usually express them to the public. In the case of Syria, the cables show that regime change had been a long-standing goal of U.S. policy, that the U.S. promoted sectarianism in support of its regime change policy, thus helping lay the foundation for the sectarian civil war and massive bloodshed that we see in Syria today. The key components of the Bush administration's regime change policy remained in place even as the Obama administration moved publicly towards a policy of engagement, and that the U.S. government was much more interested in the Syrian government's foreign policy, particularly in relationship to Iran, than in human rights in Syria. In a December 13, 2006 cable, quote, influencing the Syrian government in the end of 2016 indicates that as far back as 2006, five years before the Arab Spring protests in Syria, destabilizing the Syrian government was a central motivation of U.S. policy. The author of the cable was William Roebuck, at the time charged affairs of the U.S. Embassy in Damascus. The cable outlined strategies for destabilizing the Syrian government. In his summary, the head of the mission in Syria for the United States said the following, quote, we believe Bashar Assad's weaknesses are in how he chooses to react to looming issues, both perceived and real, such as the conflict between economic reform steps, however limited, and entrenched corrupt forces, the Kurdish question, and the potential threat to the regime from the increasing presence of trans-sitting Islamic extremists. This cable summarizes our assessment of these vulnerabilities and suggests there may be actions and statements and signals that the United States government can send that will improve the likelihood of such opportunities arising. End quote. Now, this cable suggests that the U.S. goal in December of 2006 was to undermine the Syrian government by any available means, and that what mattered was whether the U.S. action would help destabilize the government, not what other impacts the action might have. In public, the U.S. was in favor of economic reform, but in private, the U.S. saw conflict between economic reform and entrenched corrupt forces as an opportunity. In public, the U.S. was opposed to Islamic extremists everywhere, but in private, it saw the potential threat to the regime from the increasing presence of these Islamic extremists. Roebuck lists Syria's relationship with Iran as vulnerability, and goes on then, and what I have are numerous documents from WikiLeaks that show what the real motives were, what the current priorities were. And it was all about regime change. And it was all about getting in there and supporting the opposition. So why is this important? What is the summary of what I just told you? The summary is this. According to WikiLeaks, which was reporting on official government transmissions, the United States was providing support in every way possible to provocateurs, agitators, terrorists in Syria, and then came the Arab Spring. But the Arab Spring, by the way, was not supported. Listen carefully. This is very important. Very important. The United States government did not support, nor did the Bush administration and Condoleezza Rice and all the other people, they did not support the Arab Spring uprising in Egypt, in Tunisia, in any other country. In fact, they supported the existing regimes, Mubarak in Egypt, every single one of them, Bahrain. They supported the governments. They supplied military aid. They supplied funds, special training. They supplied reconnaissance, intelligence to stop the Arab Spring, to stop democratic movement, to stop movements to overthrow corrupt governments. The only country they supported the uprising was, you guessed it, Syria. Why? Because it was regime change there they wanted, and they were going to use their own infiltrators, provocateurs, and then show the American media through Al Jazeera, that is part of this cabal, part of this corrupt action, to show them, oh, well, it's Assad, and he is responsible for all this and killings. And yet they were behind it all. That the American media has never told you. That no commentator has discussed. You can read those documents for yourself. I'm Gary Nall. Now we're going to go to some audio clips before we go back to our guest who will be joining us in a moment. And I want you to be able to hear some comments from different people on different parts of what is going on in the Middle East, not just in Syria, but in general, and some of the ways that we look at this and some of the people we blame and how just misguided the entire American media is on this subject. They are so off the truth on this. So let us now go over and play our first clip, and the first clip will be on the issues that I've just been discussing.
The analyst, editor of StopImperialism.com, is with us right now, Eric Dreitzer, and he's going to help us better understand what's going on there. Hi, Mr. Dreitzer. Thanks so much for taking the time to chat with us. Can you give us an update on what's happening right now in the Paris investigations?
Well, we're seeing the images coming through on our TV screens of shootouts and raids and the killing of at least a number of suspects allegedly involved in this plot. But I think the larger question here has to do with the investigation. It has to do with assigning motives and potentially trying to construct a narrative of exactly what happened. You see, although we're seeing all of these images flashing on our TV screens, there's been very little context provided aside from assorted news stories in a couple of different papers here in the West. Of course, primarily, we need to be asking ourselves, what is the role of foreign policy in all of this? Because if we are to accept the claim of responsibility from the so-called Islamic State, then, of course, it begs the question, why France and why now? And obviously, the larger issue here has to do with the United States, the British and the French especially, and their involvement with terrorism and the war in Syria. So even if we're to accept the standard narrative of what supposedly happened in Paris, we then are led to the obvious question of to what extent is French foreign policy and U.S. foreign policy an instigator of precisely these events? And then, of course, the other question that we need to be asking is to what extent can we believe the information that has come out to this point, which at many times has been contradictory and conflicting, to say the least?
Well, those are lots of important questions that you've risen right there. And it's been in quite a bit of debate across the world by intellectuals. What do you think is the role of French policy, and of course, as it has resulted in these attacks?
Well, look, I mean, we have to obviously extend our sympathy to the people of France and to people who have been victimized by terrorism, but we can't shy away from asking the very obvious question of why terrorism struck at France. And I think an obvious direction of investigation has to be the cooperation between French intelligence and terrorist elements in Syria in that war. It's been documented by the New York Times, the Washington Post, and a number of other media outlets that the DGSE, that is French Intelligence Agency, has been on the ground in Syria and along the Turkish-Syrian border since at least 2011, 2012, involved in funneling weapons and terrorists into the country for the purposes of effecting regime change against the Syrian government. This is a fundamental foreign policy position that France has taken, and in many ways, France has been somewhat the leading edge in the regime change attempt in Syria. Foreign Minister Fabius has been one of the most vocal proponents of the removal of Assad by force if necessary. And again, if we're to accept this narrative of what happened in Paris, then this is an outgrowth of French foreign policy. But of course, that can't shy us away from asking a lot of these difficult questions. The extent to which terrorism comes back on those who foment it.
Mr. Dritzer, let me just ask you, there's been a lot of discourse as well about the desired response that Daesh wants from its victims, like France right now. And of course, President Hollande is currently, he has a very warlike discourse. How do you think this contributes to the entire war?
Well, naturally, it provides the pretext for the French military to expand their involvement to engage in a bombing campaign. Now, there's an interesting political backdrop to all of this that may or may not have figured into the calculus of the terrorist group that carried out this attack, namely that the French military and the French political establishment has come to a fork in the road, so to speak, wherein they have to either side with or side against Russia in the ongoing war in Syria, because of course Russia is launching daily airstrikes against Islamic State positions throughout the country, as well as a number of other terrorist groups. Now, the direction in which France goes, either cooperating with Russia and the other actors in the region, or cooperating with the United States and undermining Russia, that will have a significant impact on the development and course of this war in Syria. So, in many ways, what's happened in Paris is going to directly impact the trajectory of the war in Syria. Naturally, on the one hand, the United States, and on the other hand, Russia, are desperately trying to play the events in Paris and the war in Syria to their own political advantage. But I think that the question remains, how will this impact the attempt at regime change in Syria? Will this drive the French government to side with Russia in the belief that there has to be a political settlement? If there is a political resolution to the situation in Syria vis-a-vis the war on Syria and the state of Syria, then that frees up the possibility for a coalition against the Islamic State. But if the Western powers and Russia are working at cross purposes, then we're looking at an even more dangerous conflict that escalates from here on out.
So much, Mr. Dritzer. It's been a pleasure speaking with you. Hopefully we can touch base with you sometime in the future. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Now let us listen to a comment about proof that the U.S. government wanted ISIS to emerge.
On Paris, France is tonight a police state, and there is concern over ISIS infiltrating Syrian refugees. And of course, the big question, how can the world rid itself of the Islamic State? Now, before you listen to one more politician tell you what we need to do, you need to know what politicians knew about ISIS 3 years ago and the actions they took anyway. This is a reality check you won't see anywhere else.
On the military front, our coalition is intensifying our airstrikes, more than 8,000 to date. We're taking out ISIL leaders, commanders.
There is no doubt the U.S. and its allies must stop ISIS. After the Paris attacks that left 129 dead, more than 350 people injured, and an entire nation in lockdown, there is no doubt that ISIS has to be stopped. Now, shortly after the Paris attack, ISIS fighters recorded this new video claiming they will soon strike the United States, including Washington, D.C. But look, there's no question that ISIS is a serious threat to people everywhere, especially to people in Iraq and in Syria who have been decimated by that terror group. In Syria alone, 9 million people have been displaced or fled the country, which makes what I'm about to share with you so infuriating. Well, 7 pages of a secret Pentagon document were leaked earlier this year, put online by the organization Judicial Watch. The report is from 2012, and specifically, it explains the dangers of what the U.S. government is doing in Syria at the time. Remember, in 2012, ISIS, as we know them today, did not exist. Page 3 of those leaked pages state 3 facts about the situation in Syria. A, internally, events are taking a clear sectarian direction. B, the Salafists, the Muslim Brotherhood, and AQI, or Al-Qaeda in Iraq, are the major forces driving the insurgency in Syria. And C, the West. Gulf countries and Turkey, they support the opposition, while Russia, China, and Iran support the regime. So to be clear, our Department of Defense in 2012 stated that the Russians, Chinese, and Iran were supporting the Assad regime, and that the United States and Gulf partners like Qatar and Saudi Arabia were supporting the opposition to Bashar al-Assad. But the DOD also made it clear that the major forces driving that opposition were the Muslim Brotherhood, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and something called the Salafists. Now stay with me. Because if you don't know the term Salafist, that movement is an ultra-conservative Orthodox movement within Sunni Islam. The doctrine is summed up as taking a fundamentalist approach to Islam. Sound familiar? Salafist is the same belief system as Wahhabism, from which ISIS draws their radical, violent, merciless beliefs. So now let's go back to that document. Because after reading page 5 in section 8C, the Department of Defense warns this, quote, if the situation unravels, there is a possibility of establishing a declared or undeclared Salafist principality in eastern Syria. And this is exactly what the supporting powers to the opposition want in order to isolate the Syrian regime, which is considered a strategic depth of Shia expansion in Iraq and Iran. So what you need to know is that according to this leaked DOD report, opposition forces, the United States, the Saudis, Jordan, Qatar, and more, they wanted a Salafist or fundamental Islamic group to take over eastern Syria in order to isolate and overthrow the Syrian president, Bashar al-Assad's regime. It was a plan to overthrow Assad, but 3 years later, Assad is still in power, and now the most violent, radical terror group in the modern world is entrenched in parts of Syria and Iraq while exporting terror to Europe. So here's the real question. Why would we as the American public believe any politician who claims that they have a plan for what to do with ISIS when not one leader has ever acknowledged our role in the creation of that very problem? That's Reality Check. Let's talk about that tonight on Twitter.
Now, let's look at truth in the media, the origin of ISIS.
وَلَقَدْ سَبَقَتْ كَلِمَتُنَا لِعِبَادِنَا الْمُرْسَلِينَ
It is the most important story in the country. The next major war for the United States is with ISIS. But what media and politicians are not telling you the truth about, where ISIS came from, who created them, and why before one more dollar is spent, one more American life lost, you need to know the truth. The first step toward truth is to be informed. The name ISIS is one that every American knows by now. The biggest threat to our national security since Al-Qaeda, right? They are a brutal, savage group known for public beheadings and mass executions. They are the face of the new war on terror. Right now, the U.S. military is conducting airstrikes in Syria in a supposed attempt to take out ISIS targets. Meanwhile, the White House and military leaders are talking about possible boots on the ground in Iraq again, only 3 years after the war in Iraq was declared over. In fact, this war, according to former Defense Secretary Leon Panetta, could last for decades.
I think we're looking at kind of a 30-year war. History here.
Allahu Akbar!
So who exactly is ISIS? And where did they come from?
It's entirely a creation of the United States' behavior in Iraq. That's how we got to where we are. Because of war, because of occupation, because of torture.
For answers, we traveled to Los Angeles to meet with Angela Keaton, the founder of antiwar.com.
We destabilized and wrecked Iraq. I mean, it caused it to fail miserably, and that's entirely the responsibility of the United States government. There's no one else at fault there. I mean, as horrible as Saddam Hussein was, Iraq was not unstable. It was a functioning country as much as those sorts of things go, and was not a particularly horrible hellhole if you were a religious minority.
To understand where ISIS comes from, you have to understand two storylines. The first is what Keaton just said. When the U.S. first went into Iraq, we blew the country apart. We destroyed the government, toppled Saddam Hussein, destroyed infrastructure, and most importantly, left behind a power vacuum, one that would have never have existed had Hussein not been overthrown by the U.S. government. Daniel McAdams with the Ron Paul Institute says this is an historical fact that media just won't discuss.
All of this has to do with U.S. action in the region, which destroyed the infrastructure, which destroyed Iraqi society, which destroyed the government. You had a lot of people who lived under Saddam Hussein, who may not have been as happy as larks. Nevertheless, they were living somewhat normal lives. The U.S. put a government in power in Baghdad that all of a sudden was their enemies, that treated them very, very badly.
Now that is the easy part of the story. The U.S. created conditions in Iraq where ISIS could get its start. But here's the other storyline that you have to understand. that even with Saddam gone, ISIS still couldn't have risen to power had it not been for what happened next. ISIS actually began as a small insurgent group in Iraq in 2006. They had no money, no real ability to recruit, but they did work to create very limited problems for the U.S. military. It wasn't until 2009 that ISIS shifted its focus from Iraq, where it was largely unsuccessful in developing a foothold, and focused on the civil war in Syria. Even there, ISIS struggled to gain any foothold, because the two largest groups fighting against President Bashar al-Assad were al-Nusra Front, or al-Qaeda, and the Free Syrian Army. Then came a pivotal moment that most Americans aren't even aware of. In June of 2013, a northern general for the Free Syrian Army spoke out on Al Jazeera Qatar and stated that if international forces did not send weapons, the rebels attempting to overthrow Syrian President Bashar al-Assad would lose their war in just 1 month. Well, only months before, I had personally confronted President Obama about why the U.S. was covertly funding those Syrian rebels.
And yet there's some concern about the U.S. funding the Syrian opposition when there are a lot of reports that al-Qaeda is kind of heading up that opposition. How do you justify the two?
Well, I share that concern. And so what we've done is to say we will provide non-lethal assistance to Syrian opposition leadership that are committed to a political transition, committed to an observance of human rights. We're not going to just dive in and get involved with a civil war that, in fact, involves some elements of people who are genuinely trying to get a better life, but also involve some folks who would, over the long term, do the United States harm.
So even as the president acted as if he was being careful, politicians like Senator John McCain demanded action.
So it's a totally unfair and unbalanced fight. And now the rebels are the freedom fighters. The Syrian National Army are being beaten every place around Syria because of the overwhelming firepower. And air power is really the deciding factor. So you've got to take their air power out of it. You've got to have a safe zone where they can operate, train, and equip. And we've got to turn this thing around.
So what happened? Well, within just a matter of weeks of that Syrian general making his plea for international help, the U.S., the Saudis, Jordan, Qatar, Turkey, and Israel began providing weapons and training and money to the so-called rebel Free Syrian Army. By September of 2013, American media outlets, including CNN and the Washington Post, were reporting that CIA-funded weapons...
There you have it. John McCain supporting the terrorist, because that's who got the money and the training and who were the largest single recruit groups coming to ISIS, the Syrian army. And so that's the consequences of that kind of radicalized sociopathic behavior. Our final clip before we go to Dr. Pollack is who benefits from all this? The war profiteers. Let's hear this short clip.
At the UN General Assembly this week, the U.S. and Russia pointed fingers at one another for the devastating war in Syria and the resulting refugee crisis. Obama took a subtle jab at Putin's defense of the Syrian government, saying,
"In accordance with this logic, we should support tyrants like Bashar al-Assad, who drops barrel bombs to massacre innocent children, because the alternative is surely worse."
Obama's kind of right about Russia. The country has sent tanks and aircraft, as well as military advisors, to beef up Assad's defenses. But the U.S. is by no means an innocent bystander. Weapons the U.S. supplied to rebel opposition groups in Syria have inadvertently ended up in the hands of al-Qaeda. And in Iraq, weapons meant for the Iraqi army ended up in the hands of ISIS. In fact, the U.S. happens to be the biggest arms supplier in the world. The U.S. has supplied countries like Israel, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt with complex weapon systems, even as their governments have been blamed for committing human rights abuses with those weapons. The thing is, the weapons industry is big business, worth $85 billion worldwide. U.S. companies, including Lockheed Martin and Boeing, sold more than $23.7 billion in arms last year to nearly 100 different countries. And arms exports have actually increased under Obama by 23%, the most of any administration since World War II. The majority of U.S. weapons exports end up in Asia and Oceania, although the Middle East received 32% of all exports in 2014. And because domestic sales have declined in recent years, U.S. companies have all the more reason to look abroad. Earlier this year, Lockheed Martin CEO Marilyn Hewson said that the company is looking at the, quote, volatility in both the Middle East and Asia Pacific as a way to increase their sales internationally.
In both of those regions, which are growth areas for us, we expect that there's going to continue to be opportunities for us to bring our capabilities to them.
In other words, the more war, the more profit. Now, Congress does control the export of U.S.-made weapons, but the defense industry keeps Congress on their side with $150 million in campaign contributions and lobbying last year alone. Pope Francis even called out the U.S. during a recent speech to Congress. He said the reason deadly weapons are being sold to groups and governments around the world is simply for money.
Money that is drenched in blood, often innocent blood.
So is the business of war worth the profit when you consider the human cost?
And finally, someone in the United States government, a very important person, had this to say that was shared with Common Dreams. Quote, huge error, former U.S. military chief admits, Iraq invasion spawned ISIS. Quote, the U.S. is poised to repeat all the same mistakes in Syria that it made in Iraq after 9/11, says former head of the Defense Intelligence Agency. The 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq fueled the creation of the Islamic State today and must serve as a warning against similar rash military interventions in Syria, a former U.S. intelligence chief said in an interview with German media on Sunday. Quote, when 9/11 occurred, all the emotions took over, and our response was, where did these bastards come from? Let's go kill them. Let's go get them. Instead of asking why they attacked us, we asked where they came from. Former U.S. Special Forces Chief Mike Flynn, who also served as director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, told Der Spiegel, quote, then we strategically marched in the wrong direction. In recent weeks, ISIS has claimed responsibility for attacks in Lebanon and Paris and the bombing of a Russian airplane over the Syrian Sinai Peninsula, which together killed hundreds of people. Following the attacks, the French president vowed a merciless response against the group in Syria and Iraq. And echoing long-held arguments made by other experts, Flynn said Sunday that increased airstrikes and other offensives could be seen as an attempt to, quote, invade or even own Syria, and that the fight against militant groups like ISIS will only succeed or make progress through collaborative efforts with both Western and Arab nations. He also said that it was wrong what we did. And by the way, did you know, I didn't until he said this to Der Spiegel, quote, that U.S. military already had the ISIS leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, in our hands. He was imprisoned in a military camp but got cleared later as harmless to a U.S. military commission. How could that fatal mistake happen? Quote, we were too dumb. We didn't understand who we had at that moment. And so there you have one of the top people in all of America saying, we made a mistake from the very beginning. Quote, we totally blew it. You bet. Now to my guest. Professor Norman Pollack, you've been listening to these comments. I would like for you to give your perspective
on
what we know now, that what we could do as a nation to intercede.
Wow. First, let me say that I don't believe in mistakes and being too dumb. I think that release from jail is part of a policy. I just don't credit that kind of excuse-making. What I'd kind of like to just get at for a second is the possible connection between Israel and ISIS. And what you see, I think, is this kind of tangled web of political alignments in the Middle East, which obscures these connections. And even though they're own religious belief systems are so different, they do share, that is, Israel and ISIS, they do share a basic geopolitical framework of realpolitik. And by that I mean that they identify together their respective enemies. So that if you take that old adage, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, even though it doesn't work all the time, I think it applies here. And it's centered on the common purpose of displacing the Assad government in Syria, and then, as part of that, drawing in the U.S., Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and Qatar to sanctify what has become, between them, this marriage of convenience. So that I found it kind of strange, and I might be missing a great deal here, that Israel has been noticeably quiet about mounting opposition to ISIS, and ditto ISIS with respect to Israel. And both of them share the as part of that anti-Assad coalition, they share this clear hostility toward both Iran and Russia, which are Assad's chief backers. And I hate to harp on that international context, but I just feel that I jotted down to myself as the audio portions were being played, that if Syria falls, then all things are possible. And what I think I have in mind here is that that intensifies the opportunity for a confrontation with Russia. And I have still this sense that unless one treats Russia and China in an integrated geopolitical framework, where the United States is, I think, hell-bent on isolating and weakening both. And we have that, pretty much that evidence. We have that evidence certainly with respect to China. And when we discuss the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the thing that is almost never mentioned is that it really exists on the basis of military underpinnings. We have joint maneuvers with these various countries. China, by definition, is excluded. China is encircled similarly to the way Russia is encircled by NATO forces and those 800 military bases, and still counting, that the United States has mounted. So we've got here a much larger, I think, a broader panorama of repression, a kind of comprehensive paradigm of military expansion. And if you get down now to Israel, and these are only perhaps straws in the wind and don't really tell us nearly enough, but we found in one report recently that the Israeli Air Force has been engaged in bombing raids in Syria to support that Free Syrian Army and al-Nusra, the al-Nusra Front, and as part of that pool of opposition. And we found that the reports that an IDF colonel was captured by the Iraqi army on the Salahuddin Front as part of the ISIS units. I mean, you can't get too much closer than that to this kind of complicity or common purpose. And although the evidence is scattered, it was mentioned by one of in one of the audio tapes about the Salafists. And what we see here is that the Salafist principality in eastern Siberia, I'm sorry, terrible mistake. I was up since 4 a.m. in eastern Syria, which is now ISIS territory, that has been very much supported by the U.S. and by the various rebel forces, and that poses a direct threat to Assad. And then poor Assad, he's getting help from Hezbollah in fighting on the side of the Syrian army, not the Syrian Free Syrian Army, but the actual Syrian army against ISIS, which is, of course, reason enough for Israel to oppose Iran, which is Hezbollah's sponsor, and to oppose Assad. There's also, and I leave this to your more knowledgeable people, because this is not an area that I can claim any kind of fundamental knowledge on, is that UN Disengagement and Observer Force, the UNDOF or DOF, which is stationed on the Golan Heights between Israel and Syria, and it has reported that it has seen Israel actually working closely with al-Nusra. And there are a number of places where it seems like Israel is showing up in this. And I don't know if I would place a huge amount of emphasis on that as compared with the factor of Turkey. But I did want to mention one thing that, again, I can't claim expertise on, but was not really mentioned, and that is that up until now, the Russian pipeline for pipelines for natural gas and for oil to the EU has been going, and as part of this attempt at, I think, curtailing the power and influence of Russia, one of the factors in pushing for Assad's downfall is to have an alternate route for oil and for gas, an alternate pipeline route through Syria and then into Western Europe. And so, although I don't tend to place that much emphasis on oil, I think there, in addition to what you brought out and others may have, that that oil has been a principal source of revenue for ISIS, that in addition to that, there is that geopolitical framework where if Russia can be circumvented, halted, whatever one wants to call it, that this is really part of the wider confrontation aiming toward the weakening of Russia as a factor in international politics. And I hate to say it, but I think the sky's the limit for these guys, and it's not only containment and isolation, but it's almost a sense of dismemberment. And dismemberment in pulling off some of the older republics from the former Soviet Union and what have you. But I think that I shudder to think that we are so far along that we're almost willing to risk a nuclear conflagration. And it's that kind of ideological, what can I call it, not pitch perfect, but just that ideological rigidity that would almost say we will go to that limit, as one saw with the Cuban Missile Crisis, for example, will go to that limit as a way of demonstrating our, among other things, our moral superiority or our claims to global leadership. So Syria is awfully important, but I don't think it's all important in its own right. And that's not to dismiss the horrible fate that had awaited the Syrian population, but with the sarin gas kind of frame up, if I may, one gets that sense that the West and led by the U.S. will go all out to discredit and overthrow Assad, regardless of truth, regardless of facts, and so on, and that. For me, and again, perhaps I see it differently from so many others, but for me, that is really code or shorthand for the larger global confrontation. And I don't think that the U.S. Would be satisfied. I might add just one other thing. It's sort of a puzzle in a way. There are some EU members who are beginning to question the value of having Turkey in the alliance and or in the arrangement and in NATO, and that Erdogan has just, let's say, exceeded instructions or what have you. But the point is that the way things stand, if Turkey goes toe-to-toe with Russia in some way, I think the machinery of NATO is such that presumed harm to one member will then enlist the support of all the other members. And when we get to that stage, we're in awful trouble. So you asked, though, Gary, about what comes next or what to do, and I'm at a complete loss, because it seems to me that if I were speaking in some kind of traditional radical way, I would say that somehow people power to register dissent and to question policy, et cetera, would turn things around. But I don't know.
You may be right, but let us save your solutions for another program.
Okay.
My guest, Professor Norman
Pollack,
one of the world's leading authorities on the anti-war activities over the decades. He's been in it for over 60 years. He's a two-time Guggenheim Fellow, graduate of Harvard, professor at Yale and Wayne State and University of Michigan. I thank you very much for being with us. This concludes part two of our special investigative report on making sense in the Middle East. And just to understand, we have more than 16 Sunni jihadi groups alone, and six of those are recognized as part of Al-Qaeda network. And of course, there's ISIS, which is everyone's enemy, even if only Russia, the Kurds, and the Syrians themselves are doing anything really to get rid of the caliphate. And we have U.S., France, Libya, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Egypt, and the United Arab Emirates and Jordan, and plus then the other supporters in the background, the U.K., Canada, Germany, Netherlands, and they're all involved. We're just trying to make a little sense out of this so that the next time you read a news story on it, you have a better and more objective perspective. Thank you for listening. I'm Gary Nall.